am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Come in, sit close. I've missed this. Do you remember where we left off? Martha Hughes Cannon, casting her ballot in a country that had only just decided women were allowed to. We spent so many weeks together in that fight. Courtrooms, podiums, women standing up in rooms that did not want them standing. I loved that season with you. I loved watching you. Watch them win. But today I want to take you somewhere much quieter. No courtroom, no crowd. Just one room, late in the day, and a question I've been turning over for 800 years, long before ballots, long before any of that noise. It starts with flour, and tired hands, and whether that tiredness might be something more than it looks like. Come with me. Picture a bakery near closing. Not a grand one, a small one, the kind tucked into a street you'd walk past without noticing if you didn't already know what was inside. The ovens have gone quiet now, ticking as they cool. The last loaves sit in the window, their crust still breathing out warmth. And there at the counter, a baker. I won't tell you which century, which country, it doesn't matter. I've watched this same figure in 100 forms, 1,000 years apart, and they always look the same at this hour. Flour ground into the creases of the hands, ground in so deep it will still be there tomorrow and the day after. A forearm wiped across a forehead, leaving one more pale streak behind. And under all of it, a particular kind of tired. Not the tired of sitting too long, but the tired that comes from a body that has been useful since before the sun was up. I have sat with this tiredness more times than I can count. I used to think it was only that, weariness, plain and ordinary, the toll a day takes on flesh. But I noticed something, watching close enough for long enough. There is a stillness that comes over a person at the end of honest work. A kind of quiet in the shoulders. And I have seen that same stillness in temples, in small rooms where people kneel and murmur and close their eyes. Don't tell anyone I said this, but I have started to wonder whether they are the same thing, wearing different clothes. I wondered it long before this bakery, too. There was a man I knew. Well, knew is generous. I watched him the way I watch everyone, from just outside the edges of the room, who built an entire life around this very question. Whether the baker and the one who kneels are doing anything different from each other at all. He lived 800 years ago in Morocco, then Tunisia, then Egypt. He went blind before the end of his life and kept teaching anyway. And he left behind a tower in Alexandria, three floors stacked one on top of the other. That answers this question better than words ever could. Let me tell you about him. His name was Abu al-Hassan al-Shadili. He was born near Tetouan on the northern edge of Morocco in the year 1196. His family carried two lines of descent that mattered greatly in that world. Through his father, back to the prophet's own tribe by way of the Idrisid rulers of Morocco. Through his mother, into a royal Berber line of the Gamara people. He came into the world, in other words, already carrying two inheritances that most people spend a lifetime choosing between. He would spend much of his youth doing exactly that, choosing or trying to. Even as a young man, he was extraordinary. He studied law in Fez, and scholars twice his age found themselves outmatched arguing with him. He could have simply stayed there, becoming one more brilliant jurist among many, but something in him wasn't satisfied by argument, however skillfully won. He felt pulled toward the wilderness, toward the ascetic's path, the cave, the desert, a life spent entirely in worship and nothing else. And at the very same time, he felt pulled toward the town, toward scholars, toward the company of good and learned people, toward a life lived among others. He could not decide. So he did what restless, searching people have always done. He started walking. He traveled east, all the way to Iraq, looking for a teacher who could resolve what was pulling him in two directions. He found a Sufi master there named Al-Wasiti, who told him something unexpected. The answer is not here. Go home. Your teacher is waiting in the country you already left. So he turned around and went back, all the way to a mountain above Tetouan called Jabal al-Alam, where he climbed to a cave and found a man named Abdus Salam ibn Mashish, known to those who knew such things as the Pole of the West. I remember that first night on the mountain, or I remember hearing of it so many times from so many who told the story after, that it feels as if I do. The young man slept at the mouth of the cave, turning his old question over one more time, solitude or the company of others. And in the dark he heard his new teacher praying, not for comfort, but for something stranger. Ibn Mishish was asking God to take away the affection of other people, so that he would have nowhere left to turn but toward the divine alone. In the morning, when the young man asked his teacher how he fared, Ibn Mishish gave him an answer that turned his whole question inside out. I complain to God of the coolness of contentment, just as you complain of the heat of your own choosing. He feared, he said, that too much peace might make him forget his duty. The young man understood in that moment that he had found what he came for. He stayed. He was changed. His teacher sent him onward eventually to a place in Tunisia called Shadila, and it was there that he took the name history would remember, Al-Shadili. He built his first house of teaching in Tunis in 1228, gathering around him 40 students who came to be called the 40 Friends. His path proved so compelling that it drew people from every corner of life, even the families of rulers. Years later in Egypt, a sultan gave him something remarkable. An old tower built into the walls of Alexandria. And there, he did something I want you to picture clearly because we'll return to it. He put his family on the top floor. He turned another floor into a mosque where he taught, and another became a place of retreat for his students, small cells for prayer and solitude. One tower, three floors, no walls between them at all. That tower unsettled people. I want you to understand that, because it's easy now, looking back, to think of a Sufi order as simply another respected thread in the tapestry of Islam. Something safe, something settled. It was not settled at all in his own time. The pious world he lived in had its own expectations of what holiness looked like. A serious seeker withdrew. He wore the mark of his withdrawal, a particular cloak, a particular poverty. He kept to the desert or the cell, or at the very least kept himself apart from the ordinary business of buying and selling, marrying and raising children, arguing over the price of grain. Sanctity, in the minds of many scholars watching him, required distance from the marketplace. It required a kind of visible sacrifice. Al-Shadili gave none of that. He dressed well. He kept close company with sultans and merchants and legal scholars, the very people other mystics were taught to leave behind. He did not fast himself into the desert. He stayed in the tower, on the family floor, on the teaching floor, moving easily between them, and told anyone who would listen that this was not a compromise. This was the whole point. Be with God and be with people. That was the heart of what he taught, distilled down to its simplest form. Not God instead of people, not people instead of God. Both held at once, without either one crowding out the other. And he went further than mere words. When someone came to him wanting to become his student, wanting to formally join his path, he would ask a question first. What is your trade? If the answer came back empty, if a person had no profession, no craft, no way of being useful in the ordinary economy of human life, he would send them away. Come back, he told them, once you have work. Think about how strange that must have sounded. A spiritual master turning away the eager and the devout. Because they hadn't yet learned to bake bread or keep accounts or work leather or heal the sick. He was not interested in students who wanted to escape the world in order to find God. He wanted students who could find God without ever leaving it. The merchant still at his counter, the judge still in his chamber, the craftsman still bent over his bench, each one every bit as capable of reaching the same station as a man alone in a cave. I watched scholars argue about this in his own lifetime. Some of them were certain he had made mysticism too easy, too comfortable, too indistinguishable from ordinary living. If the baker at his oven could be as close to God as the ascetic in the wilderness, they asked, then what had all that wilderness been for? He never seemed troubled by the question. He simply kept teaching from the middle floor of his tower, family above him, disciples below, the whole of an ordinary life stacked in one place with nothing set apart and nothing set above anything else. What Al-Shadili left behind was not a new set of prayers, though he wrote those too. His Litany of the Sea is still recited today, 8 centuries later. What he left behind really was a different answer to a question every spiritual tradition eventually has to face. Where does a person go to find the sacred? So many answers before him had pointed away. Away from the marketplace, away from the family table, away from the ordinary hours of an ordinary life, towards some other place set apart and made holy by its distance from everything else. He pointed back, not away from the loom, but into it. Not away from the ledger, but into it. He took the oldest human instinct, that the sacred must live somewhere special, somewhere far, and quietly set it down again, right in the middle of the workshop floor. I have watched other threads of the tapestry in other centuries and other tongues arrive at something like this same recognition, that ordinary labor, done with the right heart turned toward it, might not be lesser than prayer at all. He was neither the first nor the last to sense this, but he built an entire order around it and put 40 families and merchants and craftsmen inside it and refused, stubbornly, to let anyone convince him that holiness needed a cave to live in. He gave the world a tower with no wall between its floors, and somewhere in that image, family above, worship in the middle, retreat below, all of it under one roof, is a question that has followed me down every century since. What if the floor you stand on for your ordinary work was never really separate from the floor above it at all? I think about that tower more than I let on, because here's what I have come to understand watching humanity long enough to lose count of the years. You already live inside this truth. You didn't have to be taught it, not really. You already sense it, the way a fish senses water without ever being told it's wet. You know, somewhere under all your doubting, that the work of your hands is not separate from the rest of what you are. You know that showing up, honestly, for the people who depend on what you do, that this is not a lesser thing you do between the moments that actually matter. It is one of the moments that actually matter. The world you live in now understands this more openly than his world did. Fewer people today would send an eager student away and tell them to come back once they'd learned to trade, because fewer people today believe those two things were ever really apart. Work, done well and offered honestly, has come to be seen for what it always was. Not a distraction from meaning, but one of meaning's plainest disguises. This is not a small thing, and it is not only a private comfort for tired hands at the end of a long day. It is closer to a description of how a whole society moves forward. Every profession in this understanding is a place where a soul can be of use, and every soul, whatever its work, carries something the world needs and cannot get any other way. The baker's bread, the clerk's honest ledger, the nurse's steady hands, the teacher's patience spent again and again on children who may never know how much it cost. None of it set above the rest, none of it beneath anything either. I have watched humanity slowly reach for this across so many centuries, in so many languages, the recognition that no one is exempt from offering their work as something more than survival, and no one's work is too small to count. It is not finished yet. I do not think it will be finished in your lifetime, or even in several after it. But I have watched enough of the pattern to tell you something with certainty. It moves in one direction only. Toward more of this, not less. Toward every closed door being asked to open, not fewer of them. And I want to say this plainly, because it matters more than anything else in this whole story. Believing that direction is true is not the same as it arriving on its own. Faith, the kind that means anything, is not a feeling you carry quietly inside your chest while you wait. It moves your hands. It shows up in how you close the shop at night, how you speak to the last customer of the day, whether you offer your work as something given or only as something owed. That is what I saw in the tower with no walls between its floors. Not a lesson about mysticism in the end, a lesson about the ledger, the loom, the oven, and about you in whatever room you stand in tonight, doing whatever it is you do. So let me ask you something, and you don't need to answer out loud. Just let it sit with you a moment. Think about today. Whatever you did with your hours, whatever work filled them, think about how you carried it. Was it something you endured, counting the minutes until it let you go? Or was there some part of it, even a small part, even a moment you almost missed, where you offered it as something more than that? I'm not asking whether your work is important enough. I've told you already. I don't believe any honest work is too small to count. I'm asking something quieter, whether you noticed, whether somewhere in the middle of an ordinary task, you let yourself feel that it mattered rather than simply getting through it. I don't say this to make you examine yourself too harshly. Al-Shadili didn't send anyone away in shame. He sent them away to go learn a trade and then welcomed them back. There's no failing this. There's only noticing again and again a little more than you did before. So tomorrow, when you go back to whatever it is you do, the counter, the desk, the classroom, the kitchen, I'd like you to try something small. Just once in the day, pause for a breath in the middle of it. Not to stop working. Just to notice that you're doing it. And ask yourself quietly whether this could be offered rather than only spent. You may find nothing changes. Or you may find, the way that Baker did without ever quite deciding to, that the tiredness at the end of it feels a little more like something you chose. Before I let you go tonight, I want to tell you something. A small piece of housekeeping, if a goddess can be said to keep house. We are closing in on 300 threads now, you and I. 300 lives, 300 small rooms I've pulled back the curtain on just for you. And because there is so much tapestry still unwoven, still waiting, I want to give it the attention it deserves rather than rushing past it. So the golden thread is going to slow its pace a little, back to once a week, the way old friends visit when they truly want to savor the time together, rather than passing each other quickly in a crowded hall. But don't mistake that for me going quiet. I have another story I've been longing to pick back up. History's Arrow, the standalone tales of people whose single choices bent what got carried forward and what got lost. I'm going to try something bold with it, bringing it back daily, building that archive the way a river builds a delta, one small deposit at a time, until one day you look back and see how much ground it's covered. Some days it may only be Harmonia and History, no threads left to trace to today. That show breathes a little differently than this one, and I'll let it. But I wanted you to hear it from me first. So more room to breathe here, and a new appetite waiting for you there. I hope you'll wander over between our weeks together. Now, next week, when we do meet again here, I want to tell you about a woman named Catherine of Genoa. She was born into wealth and comfort, the kind of life most people spend their whole lives trying to reach. And she walked directly away from it, into the wards of a hospital, among the dying and the diseased, by her own choosing. She came to believe something strange and burning, that love and suffering were not opposites at all, but two names for the very same fire. I think you'll find her unforgettable. Until then, go gently with your hands, whatever work fills them. I'll be watching, the way I always am. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.